if my memory serves me right, I was driving around Indianapolis when I had the very first hints of trouble. I was headed to an event like this. I was doing something for a church in that area, and as I was trying to navigate to get there, I got a phone call from this young man that I know, and he said, hey, do you have a minute to talk? A little background will be helpful here. Prior to this call, go back 6 or 7 months, this young man that I knew had been working as an intern with a congregation. A couple of other preachers were preparing him to preach the gospel. In fact, he had received an offer to go work with a church, and he ended up declining and actually leaving the internship early because he had decided that he wanted to go back to graduate school. He figured it was the right time of life to do that. And so he had done all of that, and now 6 months had gone by, and he was calling to say he had a question that he wanted to talk about, wanted to know if I had some time. And of course, I'm just driving, and so I said, sure, I could talk. And he said, okay. He said, now don't freak out. Don't you hate it when people say that? Because when someone says, don't freak out, immediately I start freaking out because I think, yeah, something bad's coming, right? He said, don't freak out. He said, I have some questions about alcohol, but I'm not drinking and I don't want to drink. I just was out with some guys last night and they were talking to me about this and they said some things and I didn't really know how to respond. And so I wanted to see if we could talk about that. So we did. I think about 30 minutes or so. I tried to answer his questions, and he seemed satisfied with what I said to him, and we got off the phone. But it was one of those conversations that when we were done, I just had that creepy feeling that we were not done. Have you had one of those conversations? And that there were some things under the surface there that we had not gotten to yet. And that was right, because as the months passed, I got more phone calls and more questions. And the question with every call grew more fundamental and more profound. So in one call, we talked about these imprecatory psalms and, you know, how can this be in the Bible? And then a few calls later, we're talking about whether or not the Bible even really is the Word of God. And then we were talking about whether or not there was even a God at all. And so in this astonishingly brief period of time, this young man had gone from preparing himself to preach the gospel to essentially a complete collapse of his faith. It was stunning. And I suspect, talking to this crowd tonight, that is not an unfamiliar story. I suspect you've heard it before. Maybe it's your story. Maybe you've got a prodigal and you're thinking, it kind of sounds like that. I know a lot of kids who followed a similar path. Their stories kind of run the same lines. But this story was different because it wasn't just another kid that I knew in a church somewhere that I'd had in Bible class struggling with his faith. This was different because this was my son who had lost his faith. And so I felt like if we were going to talk about prodigals tonight, I needed to tell you that. And I need to put that on the table. I think you ought to know that about me before we talk about this, because I want to be transparent with you. This conversation we're having is not academic for me. It is personal. And it's real. And it's messy. And you should be concerned about biases I might bring to the conversation because it is real and personal and messy for me. I am concerned about my biases as I wrestle with the issue of prodigals. I want you to know I try to do some things to keep my balance about that. I have a group of friends I call my board of directors, and I lean on them a lot to have them guide me and counsel me as I try to make sure that my personal feelings and interactions about this don't influence my stand for the truth on this stuff. In fact, I'll just tell you freely that several of the things I'm going to say to you tonight are things that I'm ripping off from a friend of mine who emailed me early in my struggle with my son. He knew what was going on and he wanted to comfort me. And so I'm going to share with you all some of the things he shared with me about that, understanding that if you really like what I say tonight, I'm happy to take credit for it. And if you don't, I'm happy to throw him under the bus. Either way, it works for me. The other thing that I want you to know is that if you have a prodigal, I know where you are. I live there too. And the feelings you've had, I've probably had those feelings too. And the things you struggle with, I struggle with them. And I hope that will influence how you process what we say tonight. So some of you may remember that the very first time I shared the story that I just shared with you was standing right here when in the summer of 2016, I explained to you why I was moving back to Texas to be near my prodigal. I want you to know that since that time, I have shared the story more times than I can count. And over the last 5 or 6 years, I have not preached anything when I've gone to other places that has stirred response like this material does. I have been in places where I have been in the lobby for an hour and a half after the service was over, ministering to a line of grieving parents who wanted to come out afterwards and share their story and their grief. And I wanted you to know that so that I can share with you the things that since I first told my story here, that I have learned as I've shared that story in other places. One of the things that I have learned is that there are a lot of us. I mean, I always knew there were parents with prodigals in every church family that I've been part of. I just had no idea how large that number is. They are everywhere. And I will tell you that as I began to get my mind around the breadth of this problem, I started searching and wondering over the years. I've been preaching almost 4 decades now. Y'all can act surprised and tell me I don't look that old, but I've been preaching almost 4 decades now, and I tried to think back if I had ever, Zach, have I ever preached a sermon to comfort and counsel a parent with prodigals? I couldn't remember one, not one. And then the other thought that hit me is I thought about all the lessons that I had preached over the years about raising kids. It's a file that thick that I keep. And I just thought with every one of the sermons, how that must have been like pouring salt in the wounds for these parents. I guess you can't avoid that. It just sure seems like there needed to be some balance, some consolation, some guidance for the people who struggle with this. And so these ideas that I want to share tonight have been blooming in all that fertile soil over the last 6 years. And I'm happy for the elders' invitation to come and think with you a little bit about that tonight. I have three agendas in mind, three items in mind that I'd like to accomplish. First, if I could just sensitize all of us to what I think is a large and growing group among us that we probably need to think about more in years to come, I'd like to do that. And if you sit here tonight as the parent of a prodigal, if I could say something that would offer guidance or comfort to you, I would really like to do that tonight. And then the third thing is I hope the things we say will be equipping, because as a church family, one of the things we do, brothers and sisters, is we... I'm going to get sisters in here all night long, okay? That's for the recording, okay? I even thought to myself as I was looking through my notes, dude, don't say sisters. There aren't any sisters in the crowd. Sorry about that. One of the things we do as a church family, brothers, is we take care of the hurting. And I think in the years to come, there's going to be a lot of work to do with hurting parents. So I tried to crystallize my thoughts tonight into six words. I know y'all are thinking, oh man, a 6-point outline. How long is this going to last? As long as the time I've been given, okay? I want to give you 6 words, and what I hope the words will do is they'll become sticky, and maybe 6 weeks from now, you'll remember 3 of them or 4 of them, and that'll stir some of the ideas that were behind them. So that's my objective tonight. If you're given to jot some notes down, I'd encourage you to write down the 6 words, and maybe what we talk about will be memorable. So I want to begin by talking about our perspective on this problem. I start here because I think people who have prodigal kids tend to be very narrow in their focus. In other words, this is about me and my kid and my parenting. And we tend to get very narrow and focused just on that. And I think sometimes what happens to us is there's a bigger picture there to be seen and we do not see it. And so I begin with perspective because I want to try to widen our view a little bit of this problem. You do understand that prodigals is not a new problem, right? It's not as though in 2022, this is the first generation of disciples to deal with kids that in great numbers are walking away. You understand that, right? In fact, have you ever pondered how old the problem of prodigals is? I mean, we got to go back all the way to the beginning, to Genesis 4, where the first kids, the first parents with kids had trouble with one who was murderously rebellious, right? And that's just the first in a long thematic thread that runs throughout the Bible story. Think about the characters you know. Think about the good characters that you know in the Bible story who had rotten kids. In 1 Samuel chapter 8, we're told that the good judge Samuel appointed his sons to administer justice in his place, but his sons were wicked, and they took bribes, and they were corrupt, and I imagine along the way just broke their father's heart. Can you imagine how embarrassed Samuel was by how wicked his children were? And then I think about King David, who's described as a man after God's own heart. David was a good guy, to be sure. But on the back end of his life, his grown children just did some awful things that broke his heart, that were national embarrassments for him. Think about David. And so what I'm trying to say is that what's happening in our generation is not new or unique. The truth is that God's people have been struggling with it for a long, long time. And so what I would like to say to parents with prodigal sitting here tonight, to dads who've had children that have rejected our leadership in that matter and who've walked away, your problem is not unusual. I talk to people all over the country who are struggling with exactly the same thing. There are people sitting in the room tonight who share the journey with you. And there are other disciples who, while they may not share the journey, certainly want to share the burden. They are trying to practice Galatians 6:2, where we are urged to bear one another's burdens. One of the things that I have discovered over the last 5 or 6 years since I've begun to talk openly about this difficult journey Heidi and I are making with our son is how supportive our brothers and sisters have been. No judgment, no criticism, no questioning about our parenting. Our brothers and sisters have just loved on us. And they've grieved with us. And they've wanted to hold up our hands when things were really, really difficult. And so I want to say that to you because you don't have to keep the secret. And I know about keeping the secret because from 2015 to 2016, when I was a member of this church family, I kept the secret. I'm not blaming y'all for that. It was my fault. My wife would say to me all the time, you need to go talk to someone about that. Why don't you go talk to the elders about that? I didn't want to. I was embarrassed and heartbroken and bearing the burden all by myself. It's not healthy. So I want to urge you not to make that mistake. You don't have to keep the secret. God's people have always struggled with this. God's people now are struggling with this. We need to carry this burden together. Okay, so perspective. Maybe we need a bigger perspective on this. And as a piece of that, I want to add the word culture up here because one of the questions that ought to be generated out of all of this is well, why do we have so many? And why do those numbers seem to be growing? And I think that sort of goes back to what is our natural impulse when people have wayward children, and that is to assume, well, wayward children result from parents who don't do their job parenting, right? How often is it that we make that judgment? What is at times a harsh and unfair judgment? So I've thought a lot after teaching the Sermon on the Mount about Matthew 7 in verse 2, you know, or verse 1 and 2. You look there in your Bible, Matthew 7, because we spend a lot of time correcting the misuse of this verse and not enough time pondering its correct understanding of what it says to us. And so in Matthew 7 and verse 1, the Lord says, "Do not judge so that you will not be judged. For in the way you judge, you will be judged. And by your standard of measure, it will be measured to you." So what the Lord is saying here, I think, don't be harsh in your judgment. Would you judge, which we all do, this idea that you never ought to judge anybody is just nuts. That's not what the Lord is saying here. He is saying, be generous and kind and fair when you judge. It is, I believe, one application of the bigger principle in verse 12 when he says, treat other people the way that you want to be treated. And so I think sometimes we have been guilty of harshly judging parents with wayward children. Well, they must be wayward because mom and dad failed. I should have said this at the beginning as an aside. I'm going to say a lot of stuff that comes off as self-serving. I know that. There's just no way to get around it, okay? So you just judge it on the merits. I know I have a wayward kids and some of this stuff seems to serve me well. I know. I just can't get past that. You judge it on its merits and not the fact that it's coming from me. But listen, I will tell you, I think there's a reason we want to believe that kids only fall away because of parental failure, because it leads me to believe that I control what happens with my kids. And those of us whose children are all grown up, we know better than that, right? But it creates this illusion that I control what happens with my kids. I will tell you, my experiences around the country over the last 4 or 5 years have really created me a different impression because I have met some awfully good, godly men and women who share this journey with me. People who I know were good parents and their kids walked away from Jesus. So it's led me to believe, the more I've seen that there's something bigger at work here than just parental failure. And I think that culture factors into it. And I think we need to see that. If you are my age, I'm 58. If you are my age or older, you understand that our kids are not growing up in the world that we did, right? And I'm not just saying things are a little different. The differences are profound, and the implications are terrifying. So I looked at some numbers for Gen Z recently in a parenting class I was doing. Now, Gen Z is going to be, depending on who you're reading, 25 years old and down, okay, roughly in that age group. So Barna did some work with Gen Z in 2018 and found that more than one out of five, identify as an atheist or an agnostic. You think about that? One out of five kids under the age of 25 is identifying as an atheist or an agnostic. And those trend lines are not good. Baby boomers, for example, which I'm just barely a baby boomer. I got in the tail end of that group, okay? Baby boomers, less than one out of 10 identify that way. So you see how the numbers are going up dramatically? And then you start digging into them. You realize that half of the kids growing up today have never been in a church building. Half of them do not identify with any kind of religious group. It terrifies me. A group of kids that are going up who have never gone to church. And then all the numbers just then begin to make sense, because if you look at what they believe about religious things like the Bible and God, and then you look at what they believe about moral controversies and things like that, the numbers reflect where the kids are. That is where the world is. My point is, folks, that we are living in a culture that has rejected the idea of God, that has rejected the idea of a biblical worldview, and that is impacting what's happening with our kids. That's what I want to try to get you to see. It's bigger than just parental failure, and we really, really need to see that. I think this has come up on us suddenly. I don't think we saw it coming. I can tell you, I raised kids, 15 years ago, and we talked about things like the existence of God and evidences, but frankly, guys, I just thought I was firming up the foundation that was solidly laid. I never envisioned the way that would be fundamentally assaulted today. I do not think we have done an adequate job over the last two decades of really building solid foundations where the basics are deeply rooted, evidence is well supplied, and the kids are strongly convicted. And the other thing that I think we have not done is we have not prepared our kids to be outcasts, which is what they will be in the next generation. They are not going to be able to go along with the edges and skirt society and kind of get along with the people around them. They are going to be hated outcasts, which has frankly been what Christians typically are throughout all the generations. The period we've lived through is exceptional. Someone says, wow, you are really dark. Yeah, my coworker gets me this way. He tells me the truth about culture all the time. But listen, the numbers are not good. And so one of the reasons I think we need to factor culture into the equation here is because it needs to send up red flags and sound an alarm about what we do with the current generation. These fundamental pieces of a Christian's worldview are going to be things that we have to work again and again and again. Can I be practical about that? Don't let a year of Bible classes go by without a quarter being devoted to the fundamentals. Why do you believe in God? Why is the Bible the Word of God? Why do you believe Jesus is the Son of God? How do you deal with these fundamental worldview questions that Christians are having to struggle with today? It's absolutely critical. Culture is part of the reason that we are losing so many kids. It's increasingly hostile to Christianity, okay? So second thing is culture. The third word I'm going to give you, then we're going to take a little break, because that's what we designed to do tonight, is to do this in two pieces. So I've got two sets of three. The third thing before we take a break that I want to talk about is the issue of blame. And we need to spend some time on this one, because it is, I think, the greatest struggle for parents who have wayward kids. What did I do wrong? I will tell you that I have looked back on the time that my kids spent at home, and I've thought about my bad moments, and as a dad, I had some. And I've wondered, was it that? Was it something, not that I did, but that I neglected, that I didn't do? I remember talking with my prodigal and telling him, I wish that I had spent more time talking about fundamentals and giving him more evidence for belief in God. And he said, yeah, and if you'd done that, I'd be a drunk and you'd wishing you'd said more about alcohol. But I think there are some assumptions underneath our questions. And the assumption is that if my kid does not continue walking with the Lord, it is because I failed. It's something I didn't do. And some would say, well, of course that's true because Scripture teaches that, right? So let me show you the passage every parent with a prodigal knows. Go to Proverbs 22. And look down at verse 6. So you had to know if we were talking about prodigals tonight, we would get to this one, right? Proverbs 22:6 says, train up a child in the way he should go. Even when he is old, he will not depart from it. And so here's how this passage is often worked. So the text says, if you train him up in the way he is old, should go when he is old, he will stay on the path, right? And so work the reasoning backwards. If he doesn't stay on the path, then what? You didn't train him up in the way that he should go. So I want to talk to you some about that. Because even though it will appear self-serving, I do think that is a misuse of what this verse is saying. Two questions. First of all, you will notice that verse 6 does not say, train up children to serve the Lord. Do you see that in the Bible? What does it say? Train him up how? In the way he should go. When I began working this text, I discovered something that I had never realized before. That not everyone believes that that's talking about training your children to serve God. I will freely admit that is one possible understanding of it. What I didn't realize is not the only one. There are scholars who believe that what the wise man is saying here is that you ought to bring up a child in a way that is consistent with his talents and ability. And so, for example, gentlemen, if your son is more artsy than athletic, let him be in the band. Don't push him to play football because that's what you want him to do. That's not his way. Or if he's not good with numbers, don't push him to be an accountant because you were an accountant and you want to turn the business back over to him. That may not be the way that he should go. That makes sense, doesn't it? And whether that's what he's talking about here or not, that is certainly good wisdom. And so that may be one way to understand what's being said here. But let's assume that the training is training him to serve God. The second observation that I would make is that we are dealing with a proverb. And a proverb's speak of things that are generally true, but they're not guarantees. And if it sounds like I'm being a little sketchy the way I'm handling the text, I would suggest to you that we treat all kinds of proverbs that way. Let me illustrate that for you. Back up to Proverbs 10 for a minute and notice this proverb with me. Proverbs 10, look down at verse 27. The wise man says that the fear of the Lord prolongs life, but the years of the wicked will be shortened. Is that true? Well, I think that sometimes wicked people do dumb stuff that cuts their life short. Have you seen that? So if you do righteous things, that may well cause you to live your life longer. I think generally speaking, that is true. Is it a guarantee that if I behave, I will live a long time? We know that's not true, don't we? Do you guys know Matt Bassford? The hymnist, gospel preacher, tremendous writer. Matt is a Matt is living in Houston and part of our church family now. And we are watching him die of a terrible, debilitating disease. Matt is a good and righteous man. And he will die young. Because this is not a guarantee. It's not the way Proverbs work. How about Proverbs 15:1? A gentle answer turns away wrath. Does that work? You know what? I have found that when people are really mad, if I will talk low and slow, sometimes that kind of drains the energy from the room and settles people down. I have found that that works. Sometimes. It does not work all the time. I've had somebody mad at me, and I've talked low and slow, and they got louder and louder. They just saw it as an opportunity to bulldoze me. Don't work every time, because the Proverbs is saying that. Do you see what I'm saying? It's generally true. So go back to Proverbs 22 and verse 6. If that is talking about raising your kids to serve the Lord, if it is it generally true that if you teach your kids the right thing when they're grown up, they'll walk in those things? Is that true? Yeah. Is it guaranteed? Oh, if you think that's a guarantee, your kids are still under 12, right? They are not earning their own money and living on their own. There are no guarantees. So I think we need to be careful with the way we handle this text. I think it has needlessly tormented some awfully good people grieving over wayward kids. And candidly, I doubt anything that I've just said over the last 5 or 6 minutes or so would do anything to relieve that. I don't think our grief and guilt hinges on an understanding of Proverbs 22 and verse 6. So I wanted to add an additional piece about blame. One of the reasons I think that we tend to blame ourselves is because we make it unduly simple. I told you that I have looked back on the time I raised my boys and I've wondered, what was it? Was it that episode, or was it this thing that I didn't do? When the truth of the matter is that I learned a long time ago that people leaving Jesus is not simple stuff. That in fact it's really complicated. People leave Jesus for lots of reasons. It never is just one thing. So let's mess around with that a little bit. I do want to say that I think parents matter, and I think Scripture says something about that. So again, in Proverbs, this time Proverbs 29. Will you look there, Proverbs 29 and verse 15? Proverbs 29 and verse 15. The text says that the rod and reproof give wisdom, but a child who gets his own way brings shame to his mother. And when I read this, what I see is that there are things I can do when I'm bringing up my kids that will have negative consequences later. Do you see that there? And so there is this connection between parental failure and parental grief later on when the kids are grown. So I'm not saying that parents don't matter. I think parents do matter. And so if you look down at verse 17, he says, "Correct your son, and he will give you comfort. He will also delight your soul." And so the wise man says, do the things you need to do with your kids. In this case, you need to give your kids the correction that they need, because doing that growing up makes a difference later on in life. So parents do matter. But here's the problem with that. Second thing I would add. Nobody does this perfectly. Right? Nobody raises kids perfectly. In fact, oddly enough, God gives these little children to people who have no experience parenting. And nobody knows that better than grandpas. We can see it, right? And so in a real sense, parents and kids grow up together. They learn how to be a kid and just fumble all along the way. And we fumble the ball as a parent. We just mess it up and blow it sometimes. And for those of us who have wayward kids, we struggle with that. We look back and we wonder, well, what was my mess up? What did I do? But you know what's funny about that? The people sitting in this crowd tonight who still have kids that are all faithful to the Lord, it's that way because y'all didn't mess up, isn't it? Y'all made no mistakes as parents. Thank you for laughing, Bill, because we all know that's not true, right? In fact, sometimes we all made the same mistakes. In fact, that brings me to a third observation. Have you ever noticed how parenting and outcome don't always line up? I know it sounds self-serving, but y'all know it's true. Because you've known the family, mom and dad who had three or four little kids, and maybe you had an opportunity to be together in a church family, and you've watched that family over a couple of decades raise those little kids, and they were really good from what you could tell. They were doing their job as a parent, and with most of those kids, it turned out just exactly like you imagined. They grew up, and they were faithful, and they served the Lord, except for the one who was just a rebel. Maybe even was showing the signs when he was still young. I don't know why I made him a boy, but okay, you know, boys are the rebels, right? And so as soon as he can break free, he's off. He's on another path. How does that happen? What's really weird is it works backwards too. Have you ever seen this? I have watched some parents, and listen, I don't want to be harsh in my judgment since I've just said something about that, but I know what the Bible says, and I've watched some parents who weren't doing the things that the Bible said. You could just see that they weren't doing what the Bible said to do, and you could tell by the time their kids were grown. It worked out just like you would expect it would, except for this one kid who, in spite of the disaster for mom and dad that he had, just dug in his heels and determined he was going to serve the Lord. How does that happen? How do you have a kid grow up in a mess who decides, I'm going to serve the Lord? I wonder that about Josiah, don't you? Go back and read the history of his dad and his granddad. They were just horribly wicked men. And out of that generational mess comes one of the great kings of the Old Testament. I have a son who is a gifted gospel preacher. And a son who doesn't know if there's a God. If you know how those two kids grew up in the same house, I wish you would tell me the answer to that, because I don't. But what I do know is that parenting and outcome don't always line up. And then the fourth thing I would add to that is that I've had to accept that mine is not the only voice my kids are going to hear. And I don't care if you homeschool or co-op. I don't care if you don't let your kids go to college and try to isolate them at home. At some point, they're going to hear another voice that's different than yours. Proverbs warns us about that very early. If you look at Proverbs chapter 1, I mean, right at the beginning in Proverbs 1, look down at verse number 8. Proverbs 1 and verse 8. The wise man begins by saying, "Hear, my son, your father's instruction, and do not forsake your mother's teaching. Indeed, they are a graceful wreath to your head and ornaments about your neck." Now, let's just pause. This was all us about parents doing the right thing. This is the end of the story, right? Because this kid had good parents who did the right thing. And the admonition is, listen to your mom and dad. Do what they said, which implies he'd been taught the right things, right? But I want you to look at verse 10, because to that kid who had parents doing the right thing, he says in verse 10, "My son, if sinners entice you, do not consent." And then I won't read the rest of it, but really he goes on through a good bit of the chapter after that to talk about this problem of this other voice, the crowd that is out there. And so, brothers, our kids hear another voice. No matter how much we try to insulate them, it's going to be out there. The crowd at school, or the kids on a ball team, or when they get off into a workplace, they're going to hear another crowd. They're going to hear another voice. And that may pull them in a different direction, and they may hear that voice. And it isn't just about bad influences. It's about life circumstances. Some people are impacted not by people who talk to them, but by circumstances that impact them. Maybe they get married, and early in the marriage, their spouse is unfaithful to them. Or they suffer a tragic loss. A child dies. Or there's huge economic collapse and they end up flat broke and out on the street. Things happen in life that can destabilize our faith. Lots of things happen, and each of us has to decide how we will respond to those things. And so in my friend's email, one of the things that he said to me, first thing he said to me was, it's not your fault. And then in parentheses next to that, he said, whatever you just said to disagree with me, it's still not your fault. And I don't think that comment had anything to do with my parenting. He really didn't know much about my parenting. He went on to explain, and I thought this was really insightful. He said, you know, when your son was doing well, you took too much credit. And now that he's doing poorly, you're taking too much blame. Do you see where he was going? Because, brothers, everybody makes their choice about God. In the end, everybody makes their own choice about God. When it's my turn to stand before the judgment seat and answer for my life, I will not be able to say, look, God, I would have served you, but I had this crowd of friends who pulled me in the other direction, or I married this wicked woman who was a corrupt influence who pulled me in the wrong direction, or my parents were good about taking me to church, or they didn't pray with me beside my bed at night. We never had any home Bible studies. You guys know that I don't get to say that, because whatever hand I've been dealt in life, good or bad, from my mom and dad, in the end, I make my own choice about God. You know why Josiah chose to serve the Lord? You know why he ended up being a great and faithful king? Because he chose God. That's why. Now, there may be some of you thinking, but I know I've contributed to my children's spiritual failure. I've talked to some people who obeyed God late in life. Could you imagine learning the gospel at like 60 and your kids are grown? I know those people. They said, I didn't do anything for my kids. I never took them to a church, never taught them anything from the Bible. They feel terrible about that now that they've come to know the Lord. Maybe that's you, and you could look back and say, no, I see where I messed up with my kids. If that's you, then here's what you do. Apologize. Go sit down over coffee. Or if that's not possible, write a letter and say, I should have. I regret that I didn't. I see now, and I'm sorry for that. Apologize, and then recognize that at the end of the day, whatever you did, good or bad, for your children, at the end of the day, they make their choice about God. I know that I can't stand before God in judgment day and say, I did not serve you because of my parents. But if I don't get to say that, my son doesn't get to say that either. Now, let me be honest with you about that. I understand that in my head, that logically and biblically works. I don't have it there yet. Working on that. I still feel like a failure with my kid. We struggle with blame. Okay, 7:50. I'm not sure, Paul, when we said we would break, this seems like a good time. But so that you don't run out the door, I do want to come back and do just a little bit more And I'll give you a teaser for the next segment. I want to talk about relationships and what kind of relationships I could take, I have with my wayward kids. So let's take a 5-6 minute break. If you need to run to the bathroom and get a drink, just do that. If we can get back around 7:55 or so, we'll wrap up with these last 3 points. Thank you.